Vishwadeep Koila, or Vishy, helped build one of India's best-known brand of pens, Reynolds. A long career journey that went all the way from his first job in a dairy plant near Varanasi to qualifying for the Indian Institute of Management, where he specialized in marketing and shifted the course of his career. Welcome to My First Job, where we find out what drives people, how luck plays a role, and the lessons they've learned. This is episode 7, and like every interesting career journey, it's full of twists, turns, and insights. My name is Venugopal Nair. I'm the host of this podcast and CEO of Ideascape Communications, an advertising agency into branding, creative, and design. So settle in, sit back, and enjoy the conversation. Hi, Vishy, and welcome to the show.
Starting off, what is your typical day like, and what is it that you do now before we go into the past?
Okay, today I have a dual role, where one where I'm on, which is Brand Vectors, which I do on my own because it's a proprietary company and we have a very small team. It's a team of a few people who brand, health and everything. So it's not execution, but more about strategy. So there's a small team there. So I'm deeply involved there. The other one, which is much larger and bigger and much ahead, which is ProClean, which is one of the founder directors. We've kind of come to a mentorship stage. We've got professional CEOs, we've got COOs, department heads, vice presidents, full-fledged structure. I spend more time there in ProClean, but more mentoring.
And you're into a category which is not, it's basically probiotic bacteria being used for a number of purposes, right?
Yeah. So it's a very unique thing. In fact, most people don't understand when we tell them what are we doing. So they think we are selling some health drink, probiotic. But that's been the whole difference. The difference has been that probiotics was used in human health and animal health all the time. But we were one of the first companies across the globe who used it for industrial purposes, replacing toxic chemicals.
You've come a long way from where you began in some of the small towns. Where did it all begin? What were the kind of career dreams and aspirations you had when you were young? You know, music, and you were very good at sports, and you were in the East Zone team as a goalkeeper. You know, how did you, and music and painting, it's as if you were trying out so many things. So
I don't know, initial years, you just flow along with what happens to you. As I said, Dad would pull us out of one place to the next place every 2 years or 3 years. I was born and grown in a small town in Karnal in Haryana. That's where my father was working for National Dairy Research Institute. I started my schooling in Jagwa Balniketan, which is later became famous because of Kalpana Chawla. Then moved on to various places, moved to Mumbai, was the only larger town that we moved to, and back to Karnal for second stint, then to Kalyani, which is the suburbs of Calcutta. That's how we kept moving place to place. What it really is that while it, I sometimes feel that if I had been in one school and focused on a good school, because we moved from good convent school somewhere, we didn't get a great school, so we moved on to some of the CBSEs everywhere. That was the challenges which you faced of, you know, friends, I mean, trying to make friends, traveling. I used to commute 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th, I used to commute about 1.5 hours in the morning by local train, and again change at 2 trains and then go again, come back by that, because there was no school nearby where Dad was, no CBSE school. So I mean, those were challenges, but also I do feel what it really gave me of those days were that you learn life skills so much more than what you learn if you've got everything set. There's a school bus coming, taking you, getting, bring you back. Otherwise, you know, your car, Dad's car taking you, bring back. You don't, the kind of life skills that we learned was actually, I really feel it's helped me a lot even till today.
You said when you passed out of 12th, you had to choose between a career in a not so well-known medical and dairy technology. So that was one of those places where you had to decide one way or the other.
So I moved from Karnal in a very good convent school to Kalyani, where father got transferred, and Kalyani had a very poor school. So I kind of lost interest in studies. I used to play a lot and keep playing volleyball, whatever we do. So those were not the days when parents used to go after you, oh, study IIT, AI, and all those. So whatever we learned from our friends, that's what we figured out. So we saw that some of my friends were preparing for medical and some were engineering and this. I was interested in medical because I was very good at biology from early days and my parents thought I should become a doctor. So I did, but obviously one had no idea about how competitive it can be and appeared for it, got some very small college in Calcutta. It really wouldn't have made sense. And so I was planning to, drop 1 year and prepare seriously for medical when my dad said, yeah, you can do that. And there's this, why don't you appear for dairy engineering, which is not too bad. You can also, appear for that. And if you get through to medical next year, you can, come back and join this. I said, okay. So did that. I got through to dairy engineering. Engineering always is, and dairy engineering especially was more fun and a little bit of studies interspersed between fun. So, one didn't want to come back and leave that place. So we do realize a lot of things which we learned there is useful even today, especially today because I'm in handling microbes and all that I learned about microbiology there and context of dairy is coming very handy here for me to understand how the products behave and what.
So was the college fairly well set up?
Yeah, that college is, National Dairy Research Institute is the Asia's best institute in dairy. And that college is actually known to be the Asia's best dairy college. That was fine. Very good facilities.
And then, then dairy technology. And then you decided that you're going to go ahead and plunge into it full time. Or you had some kind of, somewhere at the back of your mind saying, am I going to do this all my life? Or what was going on?
It may sound a bit funny, but let me tell you frankly that even then I had no clue what I wanted to do in life. Got into dairy engineering, was doing dairy engineering, had no clue what to do next. Thought, okay, we'll pick up a job. And then my father said, we want to do an MS in the US because he was very well connected in the dairy industry in the US. And he said, I just have to pick up a phone and talk to them. You don't even have to appear for GRE and all. Just one TOEFL should be good enough. You'll get through. I said, okay. Again, at the same time, I wanted to just try out a job. So I said, let me first look at a job here. That excitement that I'm going to start earning was just quite a bit. So then I got through to, after my dairy engineering, I got through to Pradeshik Cooperative Dairy Federation, which is UP Dairy Federation and Parag Dairy. And that's where I started my career in a factory as a shift in charge. Tough life. You are 40 kilometers away from Varanasi, which itself is a small town that time. And it was like a village. And there you're 40 kilometers. It was like a dacoit infested place almost. So where the dairy plant was.
One of the things that being in a tough environment teaches you is like the life skills part, which you said in the traveling to school and college. Mm-hmm. This one gives you a different set of perspectives.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I can't forget how much it taught me. I was just 21 when I became the shift in charge. And I had to manage supervisors and workers who are 50, 45, that age. And they used to look at me like this little kid has come here to, try and tell us what to do. And it was very difficult to even convince them that, they should listen to the UP is a very militant area. So, in fact, I had almost threats of killing and all that stuff. So net threats and everything. So all that happened. So it was a nice 7-8 months or close to 9 months that I was there before I think it was very difficult. I was doing it. I didn't think that I would learn too much beyond a point. We're there because I looked at those supervisors and all. They've been doing that for donkey's number of years. They're doing the same thing. And I didn't see how I could contribute in a big way over there. That's when I was asking my other colleague. They say, we're preparing for CAT. And I said, what is this CAT? So let me just look at it. I had no clue what this is. I knew something called management stuff. And then, how do you prepare? There's nothing. Somewhere sitting in, Ramnagar, way beyond Varanasi, there was no way that one could prepare. So somebody told me, you can take this National School of Banking book on thesaurus or something from somewhere you pick up and then you study. The GMAT book was available, old GMAT. And that's right. That was the preparation for CAT. So that's how one did. I tell people, how I appeared for my CAT exam, I would go from Ramnagar to Mughalsarai by bus. And at night, I would catch Mughalsarai, get into an unreserved compartment, come to Delhi. My center was in DPS Mathura Road. So can't do anything. And from there, to catch another bus, go to DPS Mathura Road, actually use the loo there, wash yourself, and then sit for your CAT exam there. And that's how I did both CAT and as well as the interview. So those are very different days of how one would be.
And you got through on your CAT in the very first.
Yeah. So it was.
Wow. This is the kind of thing that the quota factories take 3 and 4 years or 5 years.
Yeah. To be honest, what happened?
Natural brilliance or pure genius?
No. I think to be very honest, those days CAT was not so competitive. If I were to give you the statistics, the year which I got through it, there were total candidates only were 25,000 who appeared for CAT. Today, if you look at it, it's 10 times. It's at least 3 lakhs, 2.5 to 3 lakh people appear for CAT and very high, very, very high scores. If it was today, I wouldn't have made it ever. So that's very clear about it. So. Yeah, so there I think.
But you didn't have any kind of clue as to what the, kind of. You had some experience with the paper and what kind of questions and.
Yeah. So some of those, I didn't have too much of a clue as to how it would be. I knew it was a multiple choice and this is how it is. That's how one went in. But I think the good part was that a lot of people were clueless like me who appeared there. So, unlike today where everybody knows even the nuances, the coaches tell you everything. All of us were like completely clueless as to what we are going for. We are going to appear for an exam. We are going there to appear for an exam. Yeah, once I got through, it was a very different phase in which...
Do you remember anything of the interview?
Those days we used to have GD and interview both. So these days GDs have been... I forget the topic. Something where not much of clue on what is happening. And GD, everybody is almost literally screaming and not used to fighting like that for attention. I literally was quiet. So moderator said, why don't you let him say something? Few things I think he liked. So I made it to interview. Interview was fantastic. I think I answered only one question. All questions were good. I answered on dairy and all that. But after that, he saw that what is your hobby painting. He went on into who's painted this one, who's the this one. And then I don't know. He said, you paint, you have no. I said, I paint, but I have no clue about this artist. So I was very sure that I'm not going to make it. But somehow, it was, as I said, it's like if you imagine a situation where F1 car is at this peak acceleration and lifted above the road and suddenly you drop it on the road, how it will take off. If you survive... First 6 months, I didn't know whether I was coming or going. Difficult time. I remember my first day, went there very happily and said, okay, you've got to collect your course material. So went to the course material section and they said, here's your course material. They give you a slip, you have to submit it and they'll give you your course material. This was about 1.5-2 feet of cyclostyle notes and some reference books, everything and plus books given. So I barely carried it. And while trying to carry it, I turned around and said, so is that all for the term? Told me this is for this week. That was my first shock of my life that I got it. I said, hey, come again? He said, this is for this week. Next week, you'll get your next round of chaos. But there is no way you can pass IIM by studying every bit. That's what I think. If you want to study from beginning to the end, you'll never pass. Because you won't even finish 20% of what they really prepare you for is to, in real life, that's how you're going to be. You're going to be flooded with information. There'll be information all around you. You really need to outsmart the system in understanding what is it that you need to go through, what you don't need to go through. How do you quickly make decisions based on what needs to be right, what doesn't need to be right, you can't be just working like a donkey from first page to the last one. That's what whoever cracked that made it, but we had very brilliant students also. You actually dropped out after having mental stress and all that. So then again, the equation really changes how strong you are mentally. And that's why sometimes I feel I possibly survived IIM because from small town, you are mentally far more stronger than children who are brought up in city with a lot of comfort. And that's how possibly the mental toughness was there.
So once you wrapped up IMA, obviously, then it becomes a question of what is it that you want to do next? So dairy and advertising, if I remember right, is that what you decided to take up?
I got very interested in marketing.
Okay.
I love marketing subjects somehow. And marketing and advertising both were my favorites. I maxed those subjects. I used to get very good marks on that. And some of my friends used to tease me saying, no, it's your handwriting which gives you good marks. Yeah, because those days it was still used to write our papers. So that's about I maxed all those subjects, marketing. And then I decided that, yes, it's going to be marketing. So my first choice was if I could, would happen that if I got into Levers or P&G or Godrej or something. So, I'll go into marketing. If not, second choice would be advertising. So as it happened, two of us were picked up for Godrej, and I was very happy we joined Godrej. More so because they used to give a Maruti car at the end of, right in the beginning. So that was the biggest, very happy. But then, yeah, it so happened that somehow they decided that, no, this year we'll take only one, not take two, after giving them. So I was suddenly, after having come out of the placement, I had to get back into placement because they suddenly changed their mind. So then my second choice was, because Nestle had also selected me, but they wanted me to go back into production. So I didn't want to get back to production. I said, marketing, they said, few years you will have to do in production. Then that didn't look like, that would happen. So I decided to get into advertising, which was my second love. And I loved my stint in advertising. 6-7 years that I was in three agencies, that was, I loved my stint.
Why don't we go back to some of those early days and what your experience of learning and actually on the job and what advertising was like?
Really happened when I came to advertising was I thought, we've learned so much and I'm going to apply all that in being in client servicing. I'm going to give my clients a lot of gyan and tell them as to what I've learned in marketing. And then the hammer hit pretty early when it told you, you are a client servicing, run around, get artworks, run, make sure that your artworks are on time, make sure that, you reach the client's place on time, make sure you convince the client that this is okay, this creative is fine, and this is here to get back. Because if you don't convince there, you get creative director also on the other side. So, suddenly I found what, in Hindi they say, na dhobi ka kutta, na ghar ka, na ghat ka. Neither belong to the agency nor belong to the client side. So you are like hit ball like a volleyball here and there. But it was good. Really learned the basics of advertising those days. There is nothing that one cannot do. So I've sat and cut to have the fonts.
Letter set, is it? I think the ones
which... Yeah, letter. So letter set. You cut and paste those and make an artwork. I've sat and done those. 1:32 in the night and gone and woken up the typeset. A man from his home and brought him to the typesetter place because there's a mistake that needs to be corrected. And there's not like today, you just correct it on the laptop.
Yeah. This type drops down from a menu, right?
Yeah.
It was not something tactile. Yeah. At that point, you really knew what type was because you were interacting with it.
Okay. Right. And you can't do it yourself because what you key in is completely different from what appears there at those times. If you sit with a typesetter, he will be keying in something here, something else will be appearing there. So unless you know your keyboard wire, you can't do that.
Yeah.
There were a lot of, then you're going to make a positive, you're going to, if it is a color, then you're going to give it to, for color separation, all kinds of things.
Do you remember any of the campaigns that you presented and some of the interactions that you had with clients?
Oh yeah, when I was in Arkiswami, that's where I started my career, Arkiswami BBDO. So I was handling then Ashok Leyland and Shovelis. So Ashok Leyland being more of an industrial client that time, it was more, we used to do their brochures for various trucks and all those. And we did a corporate campaign and a corporate, AV and those kind of thing. But Shovelis was launching their first mosquito mat. And we had to shoot a film, we shot a film. And, we had to do the packaging and the creatives. So I remember a very good first time we were doing this shoot, and that's my first TVC shooting Tara mosquito coils. So the model is there and the kid is there. In those days, they didn't use dry ice and all that. They used to use kerosene smoke to create the smoke feel for the night. The light is coming through the window at night and all that. And suddenly the kid's mother comes running inside. Tum mere bacche ko maar doge, main leke ja rahi hu. And she ran away, literally ran away with the kid. We had a tough time trying to, console her and get back and finish the shoot quite quickly. So, starting from those kind of a thing. And then we had the packaging. The packaging went to this, should say, plant-based repellent, not harmful for kids. That not from the, this dropped first. For whatever reason, that piece only from the artwork had dropped. The entire packaging, a few lakh packaging got printed with harmful for the kids.
My God. Which said harmful for kids.
Yeah. because not got dropped out there. So, I mean, imagine the situation.
Very can early you imagine the tension that would be there to just break this news to the client and then...
We had forget about breaking it. Breaking it to Sundar Swami was my biggest problem. When I had to go walking to Sundar's room and say, Sundar, this is the goof that has happened. He looked at me and very quietly said, what? So, who was smoking pot? So, I said, no one, Sundar, it just dropped like this. It dropped. Of course, I mean, he took care. He spoke to the client and...
Okay. That was a large print run? It was a fairly large...
About a lakh and a half print run. I mean, it was not a small print, large print.
Yeah, I know.
So you learn
that's
very
early. Times I think you're happy in these days of digital where the number of only okay, but packs still have to be printed. You can't get away from
it. Yeah.
So when did you get to the point where you could start giving clients gyan, which is what you dreamed of, right?
Never. I grew from... You know, account executive till account director and did the same thing. I didn't do anything different than what I was doing as an account executive. Only I had two people whom I could tell them, hey, go run around here, do this. Or three people. That's the only difference that happened. Client didn't listen to me as an executive, didn't listen to me as an account director either. He told me, all that is fine, but you, this is what you do. What I tell you is to, whatever you tell me is fine, but this is all I want you to do. So we did that all the time. That's the thing, that
when you, there's such a huge difference between what is taught in college and how you're raring to go and you think that you're out to change the world and then suddenly you hit this wall where reality bites and then you realize that, no, but you have to start literally from the beginning all over again.
So what I would actually grant it to all my education is that they prepared us to deal with situations. I mean, it's not the information and knowledge that really made us, but they made us how to deal with situations. I think one thing which IIM does to you, or any, I would say not just IIM, but most of the MBAs, good MBAs do to you is they really sharpen your ability to, figure out a situation quickly and come out with solutions and analysis. You are never going to have all the information in your hand to come up with that you know everything all the time. But they teach you how to get your information, how to, analyze it, how to, get interpretations out of it and quickly work on it, or even manage situation, how to manage people, how to manage clients. All that has been great.
So you remember, like you said, I think you already answered that. You said early days of the agency was basically running around and ensuring that things were happening.
Yes.
Most of it was really, and there you had to have physical meetings. You had to, there was no escaping the physical meeting and presenting also. Because I remember the artworks, getting all that done was actually quite a job. It was very easy.
Yes.
And then sending it off to media. But I think we're getting into the nuts and bolts of advertising. But let's go back to So when did this switch happen?
So actually, it was more of an accident. I moved out of Mudra, as you would know, after I got married, and husband and wife were not allowed to be in the same agency. So, obviously they preferred the wife to the husband. So they kept the wife and told the husband to get out. So I was fortunate enough that David said, okay, Vishy, come with me. We'll start this Interact Vision. And that's how it happened. So we had a good time in Interact Vision handling Henkel as a client. That was mostly a sole client, I would say. We were handling predominantly. There's a lot of work there. But I think that's the time when I handled the client for about three months or so. So he kind of remembered me, asked the recruitment agency that, do you know this guy? He was in between there. He was in Mudra. Where is he? So they said, yeah, he's there, very much there. But that's how they called me. And then said, come over. So I was, as usual, very unsure because it was a completely owner-driven company run by two gentlemen. And I was, I would say, after Mr. Ishwar Das, I was the first professional to join that place. So as my luck would have it, I joined and Mr. Ishwar Das left. So I was left holding on to this myself. So that was, but then it was, again, another phase of learning. How do you grow with an entrepreneur and how you grow an organization in an entrepreneurial organization.
And it was a very tough category, right? At that point, hardly any brands were there in pens. It was really difficult to establish a pen brand. So Reynolds...
Yeah, it was difficult. So the I would say it was a very difficult category as far as distribution is concerned and, you know, marketing and distribution is concerned. I was fortunate that this client was very marketing savvy. I think if you know, Mr. Kadar has always been, who was that time handling marketing, he was very savvy, native intelligence to the next level. So he always, he would always, if I say that we'll spend 1 crore, he'll say, no, that's not enough. We should spend 2 crores, 2.5 crores. He knew really was to establish a brand and he believed in brands in an entrepreneurial organization. But what you learn is that you got to not only grow, but you got to grow the entrepreneur along with you.
Grow the entrepreneur. So here, what exactly did you need to do?
Where does the problem come in an entrepreneurial organization? That as professionals, you think differently. And as entrepreneurs, they think differently. Both of us have the same objectives. The route to that objective is slightly different. And our route to that objective is like, I also want to grow the brand. Okay, so I would say the way to grow the brand is this way, you know, you want to invest. How do you invest? How you do this and all that. For them to actually be able to, you know, buy that, you need to be able to work with them, win their confidence. So they also grow in the thinking that what you're doing along with you. So what I mean is, if there is gap in thinking between a professional and an entrepreneur, you're always going to have friction and clashes. You've got to bridge that. So you'll never be able to do that 100%, but you've got to bridge that as much as possible. And that's a very large task. That's a big task.
So you remember some of the things that where there would be differences in points of view and how you change some of those things?
Oh, very much. I mean, a lot of areas. As I said, as far as the, you know, marketing, they're very tuned to marketing. So I was fortunate there was an issue on that. First time I went there and I looked at, I said, okay, show me the media plan. Hindu, 3 insertions. Rupees so and so. Then there is this channel, so many ads, so many insertions at rupees so and so. So I asked him, is this the media plan? He said, huh? Hey, this is it not? Where are you? So I said, no, I want to know what is the deliverables, what is the reach, what is not. All those are nonsense. We know what is doing well, we will tell you. So you do that. So it started with that. And then imagine from there, I could take the client to where we were the second client in the country to be the AOR, to adopt AOR, media buying basically. That too, Initiative Media tells me that our fax of approval was 2 minutes later than ITC. So ITC was the first client in this country who accepted, went on for media buying as a separate agency, and we were the second one. So that transition that you're going to make them to come to is very difficult. They don't... easily, you know, accept it because with no bad intention, they've done the things differently.
Yeah, absolutely.
So obviously, they need to be able to convince that, yes, this is what this guy is saying, it makes sense. Once you do that, so I think after a couple of years, 2-3 years, they were pretty convinced about whatever I was saying, they would listen. I literally was their blue-eyed boy then. So it was, imagine a small company getting Sachin as their brand ambassador on those days, and they hurt me out.
Right.
And yeah.
So what is that like? What was the thinking behind getting Sachin as a brand ambassador then?
You know, various places things happen. So I always believe you use a brand ambassador for 2 reasons. Either there is a brand fit. If not, you can still use him for media impact. As long as it's the brand ambassador is not giving a negative. Doing something negative to your brand, even if it's not doing something very positive to your brand, a good brand ambassador will has a multiplier effect on the media because of the recall that you get. And those days it was not so cluttered with
Is the other problem which is there now.
Today everybody's confused as to who's advertising for whom. Those days it was not so much. Biggest advantage that I had at that point in time was Sachin had been away for close to a year with an injury, shoulder injury, and he missed his West Indies tour. And so literally, he had very few endorsements at that point in time. And the third good thing was Harish Krishnamachar, you know, who was Mudra. So he was heading, the World Sport Group, WSG. And he was handling Sachin's endorsement. So when I called him and said, actually, I didn't call him. He came and told me once, hey, why don't you consider him? So I said, oh, I can't afford him. And he said, tell me, you know, what is the budget and all, because he's right now not been doing much, so we could think of something. And then we spoke. So initial reaction, of course, of the entrepreneur was, do you think you want to spend this kind of money? But it didn't take me too much time. And less than a week, I actually signed up Sachin, and then we had an amazing journey for, I think, 5, 7, 10 years, close to 10 years.
He was a brand ambassador for 10 years.
Yeah, even after I left, he was there for about 5 years, 4 or 5 years. I left in 2008. I got him in 2004. And then another 4 or 5 years after that. So 8, 9 years, he was the brand ambassador.
Yeah. Actually, you spent a couple of minutes on that. Like you said, now it has reached a position where media is suffused with people think of building brands, using brand ambassadors as shortcuts to building a brand. Saying that if I get a well-known name, I reduce the time required for my brand to get better. Do you subscribe to that or do you have a different take on
it? So it's like this, you know, Venu, if your nail is not sharp, you need a bigger hammer to hammer it into the wall, right?
Okay.
So if your brand story is not sharp, your proposition is not sharp, you will use media muscle, you'll use all other kinds of muscles to, you know, drive your nail. With all due respect to Unilever, most of their strategy is based on media pressure. They just bang the message home. So I believe that if you have a very sharp proposition and a great product and a sharp proposition, there's no need for any brand ambassador. Of course, if there is a brand ambassador has got a very, very strong relatability to the brand, then it always helps. But getting just brand ambassador just because I don't know what else to do, so he's doing brand ambassador, let me also do brand ambassador, I mean, that doesn't work. And very often, you know, it ends up being a waste of
time. Okay. So in the 8 years that you were there at GM Pens, what are the changes you saw in the overall writing instruments market? Writing is only in school, and I think a predominant part of writing instruments are based out of school and college sales, because offices, it's almost, you know, everything has moved to typing on laptops, or even signatures these days.
So I was there for 13 years, by the way. I was there in GM Pens for 13 years.
13 years, okay. Wow.
So as a category, it matured quite a bit. Earlier, if you looked at it, the Indian writing instruments, we remember when, before Reynolds came in, was all those 50 paisa refills and 30 paisa refills, which after writing for a few lines, it'll stop and then you'll put it on the candle and heat it and again it'll start writing and again you'll put it on the candle. And that's the quality which was available, and you know, with Reynolds, it matured to a level where we could get international quality writing experience, at least, if not the looks and the features. But as it happened, every business is a good business till everybody knows it's a good business. Very quickly, a lot of people came to know, those who were making unrelated things like Pan Parag decided to come into writing instruments. People making all kinds of different things started coming into writing instruments. With those kind of a thing, the competition grew, but it also did a lot of good to the category. But of course, as we all, we think that, you know, the writing came down, what happened to the market, did it crash, or did it become like high priced and low volume or something of that sort? Nothing of that sort.
Right.
The prices kept going down. Writing instruments, one where the prices remained very, very low for a very long period of time, because so competitive category is that there's a 5 rupee price point, you can't exceed that, and there's a 10 rupee price point, and you put anything in between, will not sell. So, okay. You know, those kind of, and very, very competitive. But contrary to what people thought, that the writing instrument market is shrinking, it kept on exploding. Why? Because of very simple reason that there are certain things you can only purchase as much as you consume, which is like salt, atta, dal. You will only purchase as much as you can consume. But if you look at your garments, your other thing, you don't buy as much as you consume. I mean, today your cupboard is overflowing with clothes. You don't know what to do. There are enough that you don't even open the label and you give it off to your maids and servants.
Yeah.
That's very different. So that is the affordability. And as the affordability increased, we used to go to for our exam with one pen and one spare refill. That's all we had there. Now, if you look at a child's instrument box, it'll have some 8-10 kinds of pens from 15 rupees, 10 rupees. And you know, they're all, half of them, they dry up, then they throw it into the dustbin, then they go back and buy another one. It's not about, you know, usage, but it's about possession. So the possession of writing instruments kept going up constantly. Though the writing kept coming down, the possession kept going up. And that's how, that's also done by the industry, because what they do is, I mean, when you come out with new variants, new varieties, so people want to own that. And then you come with another one, they want to own that. So that's how it keeps growing.
Okay. Now, having done so much, what do you think would have changed if you had started off?
I'm not able to imagine myself being very planned about having, no, I will do this and go after it. Not really. But I know today's world is very different. So if it is an advice for today's people, I would really say that it's not about what is a great career choice, what is a great line, what is doing great, you know, where you can get a big job. I think it's very important for you to figure out very early in life what you like. In today's competitive world, you cannot be doing something which you don't like and still do better than the other guy. The other guy who likes that and he's doing it will always outshine you. When you're doing it as a chore kind of a thing, and you know, every day I'm doing it to earn money, but other guy is doing it because he loves it, he'll always outshine. In my view, I think today's world has also got options. I mean, when we were there, it was engineering, medical, that's it. The end of the list. Today, there's so much. Everything is around there. I mean, anything you do it better than most people. And you've got a business or you've got a career. That's all you need. Nothing that you have to be an engineer. You know, spinning the disc, you will make a great DJ. You'll earn much more than anybody else. You love it and you've got a career. So, I mean, I'm very happy to see, you know, my driver earns much more than what my son started earning once he finished his engineering from VIT. That's good to see that physical labor is also being respected. It's not just about a degree, of course. What is going to happen in future is it's not going to be education alone. It's going to be skill. You got to have skills which your employers really are looking for. Education is fine. That's a background. But the skills are very, very important. That's what I keep telling people, develop your skills. Because that's changing. Every day it's changing. Things are changing every day. And it's important to be there. I would say, I mean, everybody tells me, and I mean, I also think I love teaching. I love teaching, and a lot of people do tell me that I'm a career and as a teacher or a professor. So the option that I had in the US was to do a MS, PhD and get into academics. So sometimes I do feel it could have been maybe much more peaceful and laid back, but I wouldn't have been unhappy. Even that would have been a good option for me. Because
I think that is something that you can still continue to pursue. It's not, do you feel that this is the one, or do you feel?
So interpersonal skill is a skill which is universal. You can't do anything in an organization or at home or anywhere without interpersonal skill. So I wasn't really talking about the interpersonal skill part of it. That was always required. Even earlier, it was required. When we were there, it was a key thing. It has been the key thing throughout as long as I think jobs and even before jobs, even at home, interpersonal skill is important.
You still need that to survive.
Yeah, maybe even more than job, you need interpersonal skill at home. But what I was talking about is, if you look at what's happening today, the things are getting specialized. From specialists, then came the era of MBAs, where generalists became the norm, and specialists were paid very little, and generalists who managed them got paid very high. It's moving back from there, that generalists are not really required so much as specialists are being looked for. That, as they call it, the ICs, the individual independent contributors. That's the stage which is coming to. Everybody's talking about independent contributors. I mean, how much can you contribute into independence? For that, you need to develop those skills. For instance, let me tell you, I have been into marketing all the time. Suddenly, this whole marketing scenario has changed into digital and performance marketing. Now, I have no clue about what these things are. I'm learning. I'm acquiring those skills. I'm acquiring those skills and skills that you've learned earlier into performance marketing or into digital marketing. I cannot sit and say, oh, my time marketing was like this, so I'm going to do it that way. So I'm going to keep changing and acquiring this. And that's what I meant by skill.
So what is it that you see different? I know digital is a whole new ballgame, but what are you struck by? What are the differences and where do you see the change?
So the change is predominantly with the consumer. I wouldn't say as much as with product or the environment or the marketer as much. Because marketer follows what's happening to the consumer. if the consumer demand is changing, marketer has to follow. And otherwise, it's you're not going to sell. So what's happening to consumer is that consumer has become fickle. Mm. Because of options, when you look at product, there are hundreds of product options. When you look at media, there are hundreds of media options. When you look at the pressure for his time, he's distracted all the time. Attention span is so low. So you got to understand who you are selling to. Earlier, you were selling to a guy who would sit for 1.5 hours watching Mahabharata on a Sunday, and that's all he will watch through the day. After that, he has nothing else to watch. So the whole day, he will repeat the dialogues of Mahabharata for kid will repeat for the next 1 week to 10 days till the next Mahabharata. I mean, that's not what it's going to be today. They're on their mobile. Just constantly information is flooded at them. So that's a very different animal compared to what it was. I mean, I would say our generation when we were kids. Or we were the key consumers at that point in time. So today's consumer is very different. And the whole challenge is in how do you get their attention in such a fragmented. You have to be two steps ahead on features all the time, because the information is accurate information is available to them. So they are able to compare and contrast very easily and then pick the right ones. So you've got to be always ahead. So that's a huge task for the marketer. And
is that good or bad, Vishy? Because today, if you look at a mobile phone, you know, there's a huge amount of pressure on companies to come up with a new model practically every year. And how much can you really change? Because if you look at, yes, it's the processor speed, and it's got down to things like, does the phone lag a bit? You know, because essentially the difference, ever since the iPhone came up with the slab, all phones look, smartphones look the same. The pressure is, how do you differentiate and how do you say that you're better than the other? The differences have become minuscule. Do you think that's true, or do you think have a different take on it?
So competition is going to be, technology is become very easy today. Earlier, technology was a differentiator. Today, technology is not a differentiator. You can buy the technology from wherever you want to. The same guy is ready to make for 20 different people the same phone. I mean, today, Philips is making electronic products for Samsung. Samsung is making for Philips. They're interchanging and they're making for each other, because technology is not the differentiator anymore. So it's a marketing. It's your product ideas. I mean, some of them, which is so. How do you package it and put it across to the customer? Those things are becoming far more important. And that's whether it's good or bad. Well, I'm a believer that we need to simplify our lives. It's getting too complex, but that's a wish which I don't think is going to come. It's going to be fulfilled, because change is a one-way thing, and human nature of wanting to want something new and different every day is a one-way. They're never going to go back and say, I'm going to simplify my life. And there'll be a few sadhus or a few people who wish that we go back and simplify our lives, but it's not going to happen. Every new generation is going to keep on pushing that envelope towards more and more variety, more products. It's a one-way street.
Wonderful, Rishi. So from that time in Karnal to the dairy factory to getting into IIM Ahmedabad to figuring out advertising and then building what is arguably one of India's best known pen brands, to a career as an entrepreneur, which we've not been able to get into, but this is essentially about my first job. So I think that is where. So thank you for taking the time. And it's been a wonderful session. And thank you for coming on board, and all the best.
Thanks. Thanks, Venu. Thanks. It was great. It was a pleasure talking to you too and sharing. I mean, a lot of it was wonderful to recall.
Going down memory. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody.
My First Job, the podcast, is a production from Ideascape Communications. Guest relations, promotions, and creative is managed by Deepa Ravi, with occasional support by Venugopal Nair. Archiving and technical help is provided by LPS Jayachandran.